Documentary filmmaker Nettie Wilde's recent feature Konalina, Our Land Beautiful, is set in Tahltan First Nations territory in northwestern British Columbia, near the headwaters of the Nass, Stikine, and Skeena rivers, all salmon-bearing rivers. That's more than 1,600 kilometers by road from Vancouver and 200 kilometers east of Juneau, Alaska by air. In recent years, the BC government has opened this vast wilderness area to mining and other kinds of industrial development. This opening up to development and mining forms the backdrop, the backstory to the film. All of its characters and its action are driven by the changes taking place on the land. And there's more here than you might expect from a documentary. Something that makes it thrilling to watch, especially for people who love film. That's the artfulness of the filmmaking itself. The artistic discoveries Nettie Wilde, her director of photography Van Royko, her editor Michael Brockington, and soundtrack wizards Jesse Zubot and Hildegard Westerkamp made along the way. We see and hear those discoveries in every scene of this extraordinary film. My name is Stephanie Gould. I teach documentary filmmaking, video production at the University of the Fraser Valley. I interviewed award-winning filmmaker Nettie Wilde in her Vancouver studio. I started off by asking her about the magic of Konalina.
We were editing Konalina for 65 weeks. And the reason it took so long is because Konalina is really cut like jazz. It's really cut like a piece of music. It has a beginning, middle, and end, like all good music. All good music has to have some kind of a toe, undertow to it. But it has, when we were actually putting it together, when we were shooting it as well, we were really going for a cinematic experience, not a who, what, why, where, and when kind of character-driven story, but rather creating something that was really visceral, that people could walk into or fall into, be taken into, and be surprised. And that's what we have tried to do. And you know, it's like a... Not to mix my metaphors here, but it's like there's a string with beads on it, and each one of those beads is a different experience. And the string that unifies it all is the land itself. So that's our central character in Konalina.
Tell me a story of something that happened during the filming.
It's more a matter of which one do I tell you? Do I tell you about Heidi Gertfurt, the guide outfitter, who, she's a big game hunter. She has the toughest territory maybe in North America. And she turns out to be the biggest environmentalist in the film.
The Stikine River Valley is the Serengeti in North America. It's a land of plenty. When the mining came, it was a huge effect on the wildlife and my business. I had people paying $35,000 for a two-week hunt, and they were going home after 3 days because we were being bombarded by helicopters. It was like being hit by the Air Force.
And she's amazing. She's a really remarkable, extraordinarily strong woman who never dwells in the fact that she's a woman for 1 second, nor does she even notice that all her wranglers for that particular season were women. She just does it, and she does it with people who will be there for her. So she's a fantastic character, and when she starts swimming her string of 17 horses across the Stikine River, that was a surprise. That was amazing to look at. This is not a little creek. This is a major, one of the biggest rivers in Canada with this huge current. She certainly wasn't going to do a take two on that. So that's one person who really surprised me. Kelly Quash really surprised me. He is a Tahltan First Nations diamond driller who is very, very proud of his job. One of the first that he's gotten with, you know, serious money attached to it. He loves being in the bush on that drill platform. And he does not love the fact that his grandfather was protesting against him because the elders were coming out against the mining that was happening. I had no idea about Kelly's grandfather. Kelly volunteered that.
Me personally, it's putting food on my kids' table and a roof over their head. I mean, it's tough. I just try to stay out of it because if I say the wrong thing, I won't have a job. And then also the elders will be mean. You know what my grandparents are against, I'm doing.
That was a surprise. Plus the fact he tells the story with humor and great vulnerability, which is real magic for the documentary camera. Another huge surprise was when we filmed the Northwest Transmission Line being constructed, and they used the world's biggest helicopter to fly towers that are 16,000 pounds each. And these pre-constructed towers are picked up and flown across mountaintops, and they catch the sun, and as they glint, they're like flying crosses. That was a surprise. Never mind when they land them, they have these, you know, crew of about 20 linemen who, if you were to stand next to them, are big burly guys, but compared to this gargantuan swinging tower that's swinging like a pendulum, they look puny, and it looks insane what they're doing, trying to land this huge pillar onto this tiny little spoke. And in that moment, I think we were able to capture a real elegance and poetry of engineering, a magnificent landscape, the kind of extraordinary valor and dexterity of the linemen, and the devastation of a clear cut, all in one image. We didn't need to say one word, so we didn't.
Often it isn't evident off the top to people that documentary film is art, particularly because it tells stories from real life with real people. Explain how documentary film becomes art.
Well, there's tremendous poetry in real life, so it's a matter of finding that. What it meant for me this time round was it was really important for me to pursue poetry, to look for cinematic poetry in every person in front of my lens, no matter what they did, whether they were a diamond driller for the exploration mining industry, or whether they were First Nations elders who would be protesting against that diamond driller, who, by the way, could be Tahltan First Nations or not, right? So for me, I started to realize that my job was not to deliver judgment or a polemic. It was to deliver art. That it was as an outsider, as a southerner, as a non-Tahltan, as an urban person, it was for me to bring a curious lens, not a judgmental heart, to this. And anytime any assumption popped up in my head about whether or not somebody should be doing what they were doing, to recognize that judgment and park it, and instead go, what are you doing, and how do you do it, and why do you do it? And find this cinematic poetry in what they were doing. That was my only job. And once we kind of narrowed it down to that, it became really liberating because there was then a place for me.
Okay, tell me a story from early on in the making of the film and how you and your crew first found your footing, as it were, with this film story.
One of the things that was perhaps the most interesting kind of insight was really early on. We were filming a stick gambling match where the Tahltan people are stick gambling against the Kaska. So the Kaska Dene come down into Tahltan territory and they have a tournament. It goes on for 2 days and they're stick gambling. And I had no idea what the rules were, and I still don't. But what was really clear to me was that the players were being transported, that they were going somewhere that looked pretty cool to me. They looked like they were really enjoying themselves. And the first day we filmed it in real action, in real time. And we looked at it afterwards, and there's a bunch of First Nations people. Some of them are wailing away on drums, and it looked familiar. It looked like an old NFB documentary or something. I had a hunch it would elicit the response of weariness when people looked at it, because these are images that have become used over and over again, especially by non-Native people, to portray a kind of stereotype. And I kind of looked at these rather anthropological-looking images and going, man, they don't capture anything of what I was feeling. And so the next day, we decided to push the form. And this is where the art comes in. And so we shot it in slow motion, all of it. And in that moment, we could feel we were getting it right, whatever it was, which I can assure you I didn't understand. But I could feel it. And all of a sudden, these people, especially these women, their faces were coming into the frame and they were throwing their heads back and they had all this incredible energy. And some of these guys were throwing these really, really dark looks at the other side. And we were catching it all in this, in the mystery of slow motion. Over, I showed this footage to Oscar Dennis, who turned out to be one of the major characters of our film. But at that particular point, he wasn't at all sure that he wanted to be a part of this film. And he'd seen my other films before, and he'd liked them well enough, but he was sick and tired of documentary crews coming up and shoving microphones under his nose, and him having to kind of sum up in 20 or 30 seconds the struggle against the land. He was tired of it. And he looked at this footage, and his reaction was, holy. He said, you know, people have been trying to capture stick gambling for centuries. Anthropologists, all sorts of people have been coming through. And he said, they never get it. But he said, you have completely nailed it. And then he said, not unkindly, he said, and I don't think you have any idea what you filmed. And he was right. And I thought, isn't that interesting that I could come in as an outsider, and if I kept to my task and what I could bring to it, which was art, which was to film the familiar in an unfamiliar way, not to be obtuse, but because you're looking to catch the surprise. If that was my job and only that job, and if I stuck to it and parked any assumptions I had, then I might be able to surprise myself. And if I could surprise myself, I can surprise my audience. And it was based on that footage that Oscar said, I'm in.
That's fantastic.
I'll help you with your film. And he did way more than just be a character in that film. He was, you know, I would go for him the way, you know, when you get somebody who's a touchstone in the community where you can go and ask stupid questions and not fail the politically correct test, where you can just be this, you know, nerdy white person from outside, and you're just, your pursuit is the art of it. And so it just opened up that conversation. And we ended up with that scene. We threaded it throughout the film. Mary Dennis, who's Oscar's mother, explains at some point, she's explaining how this darn game works, which I still don't understand. And she says, if you keep going out, So if you keep losing, she says, go against your mind. And I thought, whoa, there's a window into another way of seeing. It was a complete surprise. I wasn't expecting it to come out of the rules of stick gambling, but there it was. And at the end, she says, go against your mind, and it all comes from your heart. And those are the last words in Conalina.
I want to go even further back to who or what pulled you into the making of this film, even before the stick gambling. What makes this film different from earlier films such as Blockade, which was also filmed in northern British Columbia?
I was in this, had this kind of curious dilemma. I loved this landscape and the people who move across it. I love the north. I love that particular landscape because Guide Outfitters up there, and not the one that's in our movie, interestingly enough, but a tall tan guide outfitter was the first guy to take me out on the land by horseback, and that was over 20 years ago, and I've become a complete convert to seeing the world through a pair of horse's ears. Is just spectacular. So that's what drew me in at first. But it's a tough story to tell because it's so huge and so complex, and it's not wrapped around in this particular chapter. It's not wrapped around a particularly finely honed political project. So, for instance, in the past, I worked with the Gixan when they had the nation's biggest land claims case in our history was in front of the courts. And so whether you agreed with it or whether you fought against it, it just had this really strong keel that cut through themes that you see in Conalina: land, development, white people, non-native, people in industry who could be either, all that stuff. So I'm thinking, okay, so I've made that movie. How in the world can this one be different, and it doesn't have that key political project? And I'm also, as a filmmaker, tired of a lot of the films that I'm seeing and filmmaking made by myself and my colleagues. They wag their finger too much. And what happens is that you look at these pieces that are full of extraordinary information and you become extremely tired and overwhelmed and pooped. And I didn't want to make one of those. So I thought to myself, okay, so if you don't want to make that, if you don't want to make a polemic, what the heck are you going to make? So I knew of Oscar, and I knew of many, many other people who I'd met along the way. I had no idea of how I was going to string it together in a way that was comprehensive and that would hold over 96 minutes, that had a beginning, middle. I couldn't see the beginning, middle, and end. And then I just got this idea that as an artist, I wanted to really turn a corner and really push the form. And I started to realize that the film actually, the footage, the people, the scenes started to tell me how this film was going to be different from anything else that I'd ever made. And it started with that stick gambling scene. It started with understanding, all right, there is a place for art in these controversial times. Because what it does is that if you can find a way that will pull people into an experience rather than a political argument, then you are embracing the beauty of complexity. And face it, we're in times where everything is being reduced down to very superficial, overly simplified tweets, and it's very dangerous. It's dogma. It's rhetoric. And I think that's where art has a real place, a real role to play right now. And I can tell you one thing I'm really proud of right now is it reaches out past the choir. That when you can find something that can fascinate with all the prickly bits, That means that people who wear steel-toed boots to work, who normally don't go anywhere near an environmental film, will come see your movie because they've heard that they're not going to be vilified. And then if you can get them in the movie and start, not only will people be surprised at them, they will be surprised at other people that they've written off. And that dull thud that you hear in the background, that's the sound of stereotypes hitting the dirt. And that's what art can do, I think. And, you know, I mean, it's only a movie. We can, as artists, we can contribute to what I think is a pretty darn important and big discussion.
I'm curious about the relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in the film. Something about them seems like a departure. For the most part, they're relationships that reveal shared experience.
You know, there's people in the North, almost all of them. I think that those families, if you gathered them around a dinner table, there would be people there who are working in the mines, and there's people there who are protesting against them, and there's people who do both. And it's not because they're duplicitous. It's because it's so darn complicated.
From the Broadcast Center, Prince George.
High in the mountains of northwest BC, heavy machinery digs deep in search of copper and gold. A number of workers are from the Tahltan First Nation, but other Tahltan are opposed to the Red Chris mine.
You know, a mine is opened, the horse got out of the barn. Face it, that environmental processes and all that stuff happened in times gone by. What's happened? All sorts of Supreme Court decisions have come down. The goalposts are changing. People are waking up and moving in different ways. So there are some people who are going to be embracing industry in some places on their land, and there's other people who are going to be protesting against it because that land, it doesn't matter how laced it is with copper and gold, it's a particular kind of hunting territory, and nobody is going to explore that land. You know, it's... I think there's also a really telling thing to go back to Oscar. There's a point where he is... he looks out over the land and he says, it's over. It's an industrial... The monster is here. It's an industrial wasteland, the place that I grew up. There's no room for me anymore. And then he was really quiet, and then he says, trouble is, we need the mine. And he doesn't mean for the 27% of the workers up at the mine who are Tahltan. He means that as a contemporary Tahltan guy who uses an iPhone, drives a car, pedals his bike, uses a computer, he's using that stuff that comes out of the land. So how the heck can he vilify somebody who's pulling it out, right? And he's really scratching his head over that. And I tell you, when he said that, I could have kissed him, because it was like, otherwise the first part of what he was saying was what you would expect. The second part, when he says, we need the mine, is him showing his vulnerability. He doesn't know what the answer is. That doesn't mean that he's not going to vote with his feet and protest at some point again. It doesn't mean that he's going to be a doormat with this, but it does mean that he's embracing a complexity.
This is done. We're done. The monster's here. It's over.
When Oscar Dennis speaks about the monster, he puts the monster on a different plane, kind of shifts the goalposts for me. The monster becomes the antagonist, something bigger than any of us, and what all of us in this province are in some sense grappling with.
And creating. Right? I mean, that's the big discussion that we're all involved in right now is how the heck do we create a sustainable planet with sustainable economy? And if you're not talking about the second, you're talking hooey. It's not reasonable. People can't come on board without both. So in order for that discussion to happen, You have to allow people in who will surprise you. And there has to be people. I know there's people in industry who, if you don't vilify them, because people can smell judgment just as fast as they can smell racism or sexism, and they'll close right down. But if they sense a genuine curiosity, they will open up and at times be vulnerable. And it's at that point of vulnerability where you understand that there are people who work in industry who get the contradictions big time. I'm not talking about the handful of, you know, completely tortured, stressed out CEOs. I'm talking about the majority of people who make industry tick, the same way as the majority of people who benefit from those industries and who are trying to be responsible citizens and work within environmental NGOs and all the rest of it, you know. And so we have to create some kind of space where we're all working together on this. Otherwise, we're hooped. We're just talking to ourselves.
I do not hear a neutral voice in what you're saying.
I'm not neutral.
No.
And that's the thing is people say Konalina is really balanced. And I like the fact that people say it's fair-minded. That I like. But this idea of being neutral, I don't know. I think it's impossible for starters. But it's like when people say that journalists should be objective. I have no problems with the pursuit of objectivity as long as you know it's impossible to achieve. But I think the line of our film that is controversial is that I am seeking to find the poetry of the relationship of every single person and their relationship to the land. And that assumes that a diamond driller has the relationship to the land. Of course they do. You know, you may not agree with that relationship, but it's not for Nettie Wild to pull a politically correct test on somebody, but rather... Nobody. First of all, nobody gives a damn what I think. And secondly, it's not my job as an outsider, a non-native, non-northerner, an urban Canadian to go in and start judging. But it is my job to be just really curious. And I find it really liberating because it gives me a place. It gives me a job to do. So, and that's what Oscar was... helping me to find when he said, I'm in. If you're going to make this kind of movie, I'm in.
Why is it important to bring this film to Southerners, to urban people?
Well, first of all, 50% of our population lives in the South. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's probably like 80% of our economy is driven by what happens in the north or in the rural areas or in the bush, in whatever direction. So it's really important that we have some kind of understanding of what's going down in these communities. And I can tell you that people in northern BC are sick and tired of Southerners holding forth about what they should and should not do, and they have no idea what they're talking about. They're tired of it. As Southerners... or as Canadians, we identify with being Northerners. And it's part of our ethos, being from the North. We don't know the North. Most of us don't have a clue. And we better find people who we can talk to, who we can learn from, who we can laugh with, who we can argue with in the best sense of the word, but not dismiss. We have to. I think it's really important to pull this whole country together. It's not my job to save the North, because it's kind of arrogant to think that I could do that. The question then becomes, what role do I have as an artist and as a non-native in the middle of a huge development debate, which is being played out on Canadian land, but also on Tall Tan land? Where do we weigh in with these landscapes that we are so passionate about? And that's a hard thing to answer, you know? It really is. You know, how do you storytell this as an outsider? And how can you... what makes me think that I can find a new way of seeing this stuff? And I think that the answer is, because I can only bring my these two eyes and this heart. And if couple that pursuit with parking my judgment, I just on a very modest level might surprise myself. And it's in that surprise that I can deliver. I can deliver that surprise to my audiences, and maybe they in turn will be surprised too. And maybe that will open up another way of seeing in a teeny way.
One scene that really stands out for me and others I've talked with is the hunting scene. You followed the scene right to the end. We see the guts and the blood. Why show that on film?
So one of the things that happened during the hunt was that magnificent animal turned into a hunk of meat. And I wanted that to happen for the audience. I also wanted the audience just to see how much work it was, and for it to be a visceral experience, not just a polite dipping into it. You know, that scene was double the length in our first cut because the editor and I got totally into it, and we started to see the humor in it.
Top of the mountain, you can hear me. That's what you call a white man moose call.
And we started to see the beauty in it, and the crazy poetry in it, and the fact that the First Nations hunters, the elder, is taking the piss not only out of his young nephew, but out of me. And, you know, there was just so much. It was so rich.
Yeah? Let's keep it going. Son of a bitch.
There he is, way over.
Oh, get him.
Okay, go.
Yeah.
Let him shoot. You hear me hit him?
Yeah.
Got him. I heard that bullet hit that last shot.
Every chapter of the hunt had a surprise in it, had a reveal in it. You know, at the beginning, one of the surprising reveals is the extraordinary color of this blood pillow, which explodes out of the ear of this poor moose. And I'd never seen blood do that, and I'd never seen the color, which was the most beautiful color I've ever filmed in my life, which is the color of, it's just this deep pink purple, and it's the color of death and life. We also had a lot of fun intercutting that scene with a couple of white hunters who were hunting with bows and arrows, and who not only didn't get anything, but have never even shot an arrow in the last, I don't know how many years, he says like 15 years, because they can't, it's very, very hard to shoot an animal. With a bow and arrow, you have to be within 20 paces. That animal has to be over 8 years old. That animal has to be at a place where if it falls off a cliff, you can recover the meat. You put all that together, they just never shoot anything. And I remember asking one of them at one point, well, why the heck are you out here? And he looked at me like I was brain dead and just held up his arms and said, we're here because of this. And he's spending time with his son out in the wilderness. Well, we had fun intercutting them with the Tall Tan, who are driving a high-powered truck, shooting in camo. They're wearing camo and shooting with a high-powered rifle. And for me, it was really interesting because I knew we were just smashing stereotypes every which way. And the Tall Tan were not out for an outdoors experience, although they love being out hunting, don't get me wrong. I liked it. And I like it that length.
How are audiences responding to the film so far?
I don't think I've ever made a film before that is so susceptible to being seen in a different way depending on what kind of lens you bring to the film. So if there's 200 people in the audience, there's like 200 different movies running in the audience. That's pretty interesting for me. What I'm hearing from the vast majority of audiences is thank you for not telling us what to think. Now, the film has its critics. There are people who feel that I have sold out to industry. Somebody actually accused me of being the Leni Riefenstahl of the mining industry. Well, she's a good filmmaker. It's just too bad she was an apologist for the Nazis. And this is because people feel that I haven't taken the mining companies to task. And when this comes up in the discussions, I actually really enjoy it, because what I do is I ask other people in the audiences if they feel the same way as this person, and try not and diminish the person for asking the question, and really try and drill into it. And sure enough, there's usually about 14 or 15 people who are nodding and going, yeah, yeah, why didn't you just give the gears to the mining industry? So then I try and put them in my shoes and say, okay, you're me. What would you do? I had no access to the mining industry. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. The fact that I said that I was out to create art got me nowhere. They just looked at me with a blank face. There was no place for me. They just saw a liberal woman from the South with a camera, and they were frightened of it, and they wanted no part of it. So, finally, there was one guy, kind of like Oscar on the tall tan side of things. There's this one guy by the name of Harvey Tremblay, who heads up High Tech Drilling. And he said yes instead of no to my camera, for the simple reason that he really believes that it's time for the mining industry to come out from under a rock, these are his words, not mine, and engage with the community. And that it could start with him and start with his crew. And so he gave me permission to follow his diamond drilling crew, which happened to be working at the Bruce Jack Mine. And Pretium, who owns the Bruce Jack Mine, said, sure, you want to film Harvey's crew? You come up and film. So they were very, very much saying yes to Harvey, not so much to me. And that was my way in. But my question to the audience was, what would you have me do to deliver this thesis? Stand in front of the camera and hold forth on what I think? This southerner, this outsider? or maybe not stand in front of the camera, but have heavy narration, or find somebody who doesn't work in that mine but who will stand in front of the camera and rail against it. He said, you know, how many movies have you seen like that? And how many have stayed with you and affected you? So let's just think about voice and language in these controversial times. What is the voice that I can find as a filmmaker that will surprise, that will actually get people to experience something that perhaps they haven't experienced before?
What about reviewers? How have they responded?
There's two reviews that I've really enjoyed. One was from a woman who came up to me and she said, you know, I hate that Northwest Transmission Line and everything it stands for. And she said, and I hate the fact that I love that scene in your film where you filmed the construction of the Northwest Transmission Line. She said, I can't take my eyes off of it. And my response to that is, bingo. That's exactly where we want our audience to be. And I say we because my cinematographers and my editor have played such a huge part in making this. But that's what we wanted. We wanted that woman to go to that place of awe that she never expected in watching a lineman crew land a high-powered tower. The other review that I really liked was from Wayne Bradley, who's the artistic director of the Courtney Film Festival, who at the end of the screening and the discussion in Courtney stood up and had the last word. And he said, you know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool lefty, and I like to know what I think about something. I like to know or think that I know I have the answer. And he said, this film makes me very uncomfortable because I don't know what the answer is. And he said, it's really, really troubling me. And he said, and so my answer to my question to you, Nettie, is you've got me thinking about this, but how do we move forward? How can we come up with those answers? And I said to him, tonight? And everybody laughed because, of course, there was a recognition in the room that those answers are, well, I don't know if there is one answer for starters, but it's complex. And I so appreciated him being vulnerable instead of railing away. On the other side, there are people within the mining industry who feel that it's just an Indian-loving film, that at the end of the day, it doesn't give industry a fair shake, and that it is, you know, I'm biased towards First Nations, even though just even to say that is an oxymoron, because to say that any First Nation has one single voice is an insult. I mean, come on. These people are every bit as complex as people around my dinner table, and nobody agrees around my dinner table in my family.
Indeed. So thank you so much.
Are you welcome
for talking with me today?
Right on. I've enjoyed it.
That was one of Vancouver's best-known and most accomplished documentary filmmakers, Nettie Wild, speaking to me in her Vancouver studio about her recently released feature, Conalina, Our Land Beautiful. I'm Stephanie Gould. Thanks for listening.